Support your curiosity by becoming a member of KCRW. That way you can help ensure KCRW music, news, and culture will continue to thrive and fulfill your need to know. Donate at kcrw.com/join.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Cristina Garcia, author of Dreaming in Cuban, recently published by Alfred A. Knopf. It's a first novel, and Cristina lives here in Los Angeles, so it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by talking about the inevitable subject of magic realism. You know, I was talking the other day, I think it was to Carlos Fuentes, and I had said that in a way Garcia Marquez had just shone a flashlight on an area of literature that already existed, that Bruno Schultz and to some extent Kafka had all written a kind of magical realism, and yet this dream lyricism seems really to typify South American and Caribbean literature. Why do you suppose that is?
I'm not sure. I think it would be easy to say that it emanates from the landscape and from familial relations and from the syncretism between so many cultures and religions, in particular in Cuba, between the Afro-African and Yoruban tradition and the quite Baroque and fanciful Catholic tradition. And I think that the swirl and mix of it all just inevitably lends itself to flights of fancy. Catholicism in and of itself. I mean, need I say more?
Well, you know, Joan Didion, when she was first responding to some of the new South American writing, was quite hostile. And she says that these, you know, talking animals, this is a children's literature, and she accuses it of being ultimately an evasion of political reality. She says these writers are quite sophisticated. Why are they presenting South American realities, which are quite dire, as a species of exoticism? Do you have any feeling about that?
Well, that's interesting. I think it happens to present political realities in very unique and interesting ways. And I also think it can capture people's attention in a way that more straightforward, fact-laden, laborious political treaties don't do. And you read Autumn of the Patriarch, or you read The General and His Labyrinth, or so many other works, and you have more of a sense from those books what it is like to be a dictator, to be under a dictatorship, than you do from any political book I can think of right off the bat. And not only that, but I think it's also a way of coping with the brutality of certain times.
I think that really is true. When I was speaking to Mario Vargas Llosa, I did get the sense that the political reality was so unbearable that literature had to come at it in a somewhat more oblique way. And, you know, Didion's manner is to look at everything through extremely hard eyes. You know, she wants to be there in the cell talking to Squeaky Fromm and hearing, you know, the dire truth. But it is interesting that this literature is a kind of festive literature, and Dreaming in Cuban is a book that has a good deal of sadness in it, but because of the lyrical tone of dreams and bits and pieces of Garcia Lorca, it has a more drifting and sweet-natured tone. The characters seem lost but very funny at the same time. Who are they?
Well, the characters were originally based on members of my own family. The seeds of the characters were members of my own family. However, in the writing, they became quite transformed into other creatures entirely, and in the end became very much their own women. I'm talking about the four main women in the book. And particularly the women in Cuba. I had only been to Cuba for 2 weeks mm-hmm. in 1984, so really didn't know.
But you were born in Havana,
I was born
yes.
in Havana, left very young, so I have no memories, had no memories of Cuba. And during those 2 weeks, I was inundated with so many stories. But I wasn't writing the book for another 5 years, so you remember bits and pieces of things, and before you know it, one fact catches your imagination and goes spinning out in unexpected directions. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, the seeds bore quite a fantastical, very different fruit than I had anticipated.
The characters seem to be united by relations to things that might be considered symbols in the narrative. For instance, the mother having decided that she will be involved as much as she can in the revolution and its activities, cuts sugarcane, and the daughter goes to work in a bakery and becomes addicted in her way to the pecan rolls that she picks at during the day until she becomes an obese woman. Was there a structuring of the novel along lines like sugar and the appearance of seashells in different scenes and things like that?
There wasn't any overarching plan, symbolic plan mm-hmm. for the novel. I think it evolved very organically, and it wasn't really till later when I had more of an analytical when I was focusing on it more analytically that I saw the connections that had emerged actually quite naturally. It was not planned that way, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You were a journalist.
Yes.
Was this written to get as far away from journalism as possible?
One might think. That wasn't the intention, but definitely the result. Uh-huh. And I don't think I could get further away. I think after almost 9 years in journalism, I had had it. Uh-huh. I had had it with sticking with the facts. And just once I discovered this wide open landscape of fiction, there was just no turning back.
Had you wanted to write fiction but became, because you were practical, a journalist, or was this something that, you know?
I think it just started percolating slowly. I had always been a very avid reader, and I think I came to writing fiction first as a reader. Uh-huh. And but I think it was probably that experience in Cuba in 1984 that something started quickening again in the back of my brain that I wasn't even conscious of, and reached a critical mass. And then when I sat down, I actually started writing a little bit of poetry when I first came to Los Angeles. I was in a workshop and ended up writing a piece called Ordinary Seductions about three women, all of whom commit suicide in quite original, funny, in mm-hmm. fact, ways. And I felt that there was something there, something that I had to explore further. And
Whose workshop was that?
This was a workshop with Kate Braverman.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. At UCLA or at USC?
At UCLA. Mm-hmm. UCLA. And several months later, I was already well into the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And took a leave of absence from work to do a first draft of it.
Are you staying off, or are you going back to journalism?
I'm not going back if I can help it.
I'm talking to Cristina Garcia, the author of Dreaming in Cuban, recently published by Alfred Knopf. Who were the writers that influenced you when you started to become a fiction writer?
Well, I a lifetime of reading, I know, but I had three books on my, consistently, I had many books on my desk as I was writing, but three always remained, or four actually. I had a collection of Wallace Stevens poetry, The Poem at the End of the Mind. I had Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. I had Garcia Marquez, of course, 100 Years of Solitude, and I had Louise Erdrich's Love Medicine.
Uh-huh.
That whenever I would get stuck or depressed or despairing, I always found it incredibly uplifting to pick up any of those, open it to any page whatsoever, mm-hmm. and
get a hit.
Yeah, absolutely, get a little hit.
The wild card there is Wallace Stevens, and he provides the epigraph for Dreaming in Cuban. What leads you there? Of course, you know, Stevens had never gone to the tropics, although he wrote about them constantly.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a constant theme and a kind of theme of fantasy and escape for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just the luxuriousness of the language above all. And my Spanish is not that good, and I was reading a lot of poetry in translation, the Octavio Paz and Neruda and Garcia Lorca, and knowing I was missing so much, and but Wallace Stevens, it was just the direct for me. Just it was mainlining it right away, and he remains my favorite poet.
Was the workshop process valuable for you? Do you think that's a good idea? For writers who are, you know, for people who are beginning writing or making a transition from some other writing to fiction?
I think initially it can be helpful to some people. It was to me. I was going from doing something sort of quite dry with many confines to something that was very wide open and intimidating to me at first. And the workshop experience was very good for me, just to find other people, like-minded people, unhappy with what they were doing and seeking to express themselves elsewhere. But I think after a while it can also be debilitating. I know I had to drop out of the workshop I was in just because I was getting too many opinions. And
mm-hmm.
And things just kept going against my own grain and my own instinct. And often people don't, in the early stages, don't trust their instincts enough. And they can easily get quashed by consensus, by literature or fiction by consensus, which often happens in these workshops.
You'll pardon a personal question here. You've written a novel about three generations of women thinking about Cuba. The first generation has stayed there and stayed relatively true to El Lider, to Castro, and the second has left and Americanized, and her daughter wants to return. You're about to have a child, and I
yes.
wonder whether you imagine your baby growing up and reading this book and what you would hope to find, you know, he or she would find there.
I've thought about that, actually. Although I'm not sure what I hope. If it's a girl, I'll probably name her Pilar, although I know I'll have a handful if she's even any remote, you know, remotely fulfills her destiny.
Pilar runs away from home to go to Miami and wants to spend time with her still Cuban grandmother.
Right. And I'm married to a half Jewish, half Japanese man. I think there's probably, you know, without great effort on my part, a lot of the whole Cuban heritage and even the Spanish language will probably be lost to my child. So I do plan on making as heroic effort as I can, but I think the book will go a long way toward explaining a lot of about what I've gone through and what my family has gone through in the wake. We've all been marked by the revolution in one form or another, and just what it was like to live in the wake of that dislocation.
A recent issue, I think it's of Newsweek, talks about a new generation of Latina writers, American writers, including, let's see, can you remember who you're grouped with?
You know, I haven't seen the piece.
Sandra Cisneros.
Of course.
And several others. Do you, you know, I wonder, is it a movement, do you feel? You know, a back-to-roots movement? Or I know Sandra Cisneros, for instance, has been very involved in teaching bilingual literature in the schools.
Yeah.
And that her own writing, in many of its cadences, comes from the experience of talking to children.
Mm-hmm.
But I wondered whether you felt kinship, or do you work separately? Is this coincidental? Would you rather not be grouped?
Yeah, I've really had very little contact with other Hispanic writers, although I think there is, I feel some tendrils. I mean, we're reaching out a little bit to one another now. I'm a big fan of Sandra Cisneros' work, and what I understand, I think HarperCollins is coming out with an anthology in the fall. I think it's called Iguana Dreams. It's a great title. And I think we're finally all going to be under one roof.
Uh-huh.
And because of this anthology, some of us have begun corresponding. But it's not a movement. I think we're all sort of working alone and are aware of each other, but haven't quite coalesced into anything.
The first dream in Dreaming in Cuban, by the way, I'm talking to Cristina Garcia, the author of Dreaming in Cuban, published by Alfred A. Knopf, is a vision of the father walking on the water with sort of laser lights coming off of his blue fingernails. How did the idea of structuring the book around dreams and ghosts and Santeria, was that from the beginning your interest?
All I had at the beginning was that initial scene. I wasn't quite sure where it was going to go. I had a very strong image of this older woman, all dressed up in the middle of the night, scanning the coast for invaders. And there she was with her drop pearl earrings and her best house dress and wearing lipstick and all. And the way it worked, at least throughout the first draft, is that one scene generated the next and the next and the next. I never quite knew where it was going to go. And obviously at some point I had to impose a structure, which I did, but really it went on for several hundred pages, almost in a cellular way.
Was it at one point, did you once think it was short stories that you were writing?
I never thought it was short stories. Somehow I knew this woman, I was with her for the long haul, even from the very first scene. I wasn't quite sure who the rest of her family was going to be or how it would all end, but very early on I sensed it was going to be a longer work.
Tell me, how long did it take to write?
About a year and a half.
Uh-huh. Did you know you could do it?
I tried not to think about it.
I mean, will you do it again?
I will. I hope. I'm working on a second novel now. But it just sort of took over my life during that time period. And it was a very obsessive, feverish thing for me, writing. It became something that I had never experienced, that level of involvement with anything before in my life. And finding in the second novel, it's a much more leisurely pace. It's a more intellectual exercise for me than the first one, which was more of came out of a white heat of inspiration and overeating.
I was wondering, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about. The amount of sugar in this book and this...
I admit it, I'm a sugar addict.
Well, it was very interesting because I could tell there were such rich descriptions of pastries, you know. And I sometimes began to wonder whether the woman bought a bakery in order for you to be able to think about hazelnut more.
It's a chicken and egg thing. But I certainly relished writing those scenes. I worked in a bakery one summer when I was about 16 and gained 20 pounds and was almost unrecognizable when I went back to school. And I've always, I think it's also a national trait. Most Cubanos have their little demi-tass of coffee three-quarters of the way filled with sugar and moistened with a little espresso, so I'm not the only one. A lot of people related to that in Miami, actually.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. You know, it really is very enjoyable, especially the daughters, you know, looking at the mother. Pilar looks at her mother, Lourdes. Mm-hmm. And thinks to herself, 110 pounds of consequence of owning a bakery, you know, and she decides to run away.
Yeah, the potential is within us all, I think. Well, at least, you know, within me.
Now, I also wanted to ask about the saints, you know, mm-hmm. who a lot of the book is built around the idea of miracles as well. And I wondered how you felt, you know, I'm sitting across from you. I would not necessarily identify you as a Cubana.
Mm-hmm.
You're an assimilated American. Is it a personal item of faith, or is it the charm of playing with saints in fiction that led you there?
Well, I was surprised myself at how much religion, not just Catholicism, mm-hmm. but the Santeria was in the book, Afro-Cuban religion. And it was something I grew up with. I've come quite distant from.
Really? You grew up with it?
I grew up with it, very much so. Very steeped in all of that.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York, in Queens, and in Brooklyn. I always attended Catholic schools with all its rituals and all the sacraments and several hours of religious instruction weekly. And I was quite immersed in it for many, many years. And the Santeria part of it, however, was quite new to me. It was not something that my family was involved in, but it was something that one of the characters led me to, Felicia, who's the daughter of the matriarch in the clan, started going to these rituals and ceremonies, and I had to sort of scurry to catch up with her interests. And
well, it's very nicely done, especially when she says, "Please promise me you're not going to kill another goat." And then by the end of the first scene, she faints, saying, "Not another goat."
Yeah, I have one aunt who is involved in Santeria in a very peripheral way in Miami. She was very helpful in helping me get things right.
Do you feel, though, are these rituals secret? I remember that I had spoken in Chinchilla Farm. Judith Freeman revealed the secrets of her family's religion. She's a Mormon, and her father was very disappointed in her, and it took the father a long time to accept the book, although finally he did. Do you feel a sense of violation in writing about a culture's secrets, especially secrets that are not your own?
That's interesting. Well, most of the information I got about the ceremonies is already in the public domain. I got them from anthropological books and other research books on Santeria. I don't think it's a very secretive religion, and it's virtually impossible unless you're part of a connected to a santero and his clan to get any information whatsoever, much less go to a ceremony. So I really had to rely secondhand on what was publicly available. So in that sense, I don't feel I've broken anything. I'm sort of in the wake of other people who have.
No, all I mean is that if literature can be seen as some kind of imperialism in the way it takes ownership of things.
Yeah.
This is a book that simultaneously is gathering your Cuban roots, but they're not entirely your Cuban roots. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered about that feeling of as if any book involving generations of a Cuban family will involve some Santeria. Is it obligatory? You know, where does the writing about a faith that you don't share, what does that do, you know, to the writer, I guess, to the readers? Have you encountered people who are now asking you about Santeria?
Right. Interestingly enough, yes, people assume that I grew up with Santeria, and something which my mother has been denying to the rest of the family. but I tried to be quite careful with what I did use, and it, even though it was not something that I was part of my upbringing. I really experienced it through my character, Felicia, who was quite intrigued by it from a very early age, and through her best friend, whose father was a Santeria priest. And so I felt in that sense I was approaching it as respectfully as, mm-hmm. as I could.
Well, I think the whole book is loving and comic and respectful.
Yeah, in terms of sort of exploiting that area it's not mine. I know what you mean. I was aware of that. I think one thing is to explore it. Another thing is to trivialize it. And I tried very hard not to trivialize it. Mm-hmm. And but it's certainly a part of Cuban. Three quarters, I think 75% of Cubans have dealt with Santeria in one form or another.
Are you willing to say a bit about what you're working on now in our last minutes here?
Oh, sure. Right. I'm at work on a second novel. The protagonist is an 85-year-old Cuban. He's an insomniac and an ornithologist. Not necessarily because one or the other. And he was a naturalist in Cuba for many years and leaves the island for the first time in the mid-80s after one of his sons dies in the States. And it's about his life and kind of the larger family and his background. It sort of parallels the history of Cuba during the 20th century.
And does he come to America?
He does come to America, right. And he grew up in the western province of Cuba in the tobacco growing region. So there's quite a bit of tobacco lore and the factories and the readers in those factories. And
a little bit of Carmen here.
Olé.
I've been talking to Cristina Garcia, the author of Dreaming in Cuban, recently published by Alfred Knopf. It's a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.